This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents A Death in Live Oak, a Jack Switek novel by James Grappando, performed by Jonathan Davis. Prologue. January 2nd, 1944. Nothing changed. The first Sunday service of the new year ended in song as always. Let Jesus lead you. Let him lead you. Let Jesus lead you all the way. Gospel music was the heart and soul of Mission Baptist Church of Live Oak. Not another house of worship in Suwanee County had a more enthusiastic choir and congregation. From opening procession to final hymn, Sunday morn at Mission Baptist was 90 minutes of inspired vocals, hand clappings, and alleluias, with enough sermon and scripture to give old-timers a breather and youngsters the love of God. All the way from earth to heaven, let Jesus lead you all the way. Lula Howard loved to sing. Her 15-year-old son shared her passion, which was no surprise. Willie James was her only child. Lula had poured herself into raising him right, even singing gospel to him in utero, starting with his first kick. He was the strongest tenor in a sophomore class, in both sophomore classes, some boasted. Though admittedly, neither Willie James nor anyone else at Frederick Douglass High School had ever heard the singing voice of any student across the street at the White's only Suwanee High. "That'll do," said Lula's husband, glancing in the rearview mirror. James Howard was behind the wheel of an old Buick that was new to him. Willie James was on the passenger side, seated behind his mother, where he'd been singing the same traditional gospel hymn since leaving the church parking lot. "Oh, let the boy be," said Lula. "Like a broken record back there," said James, grumbling. "At his age, he could at least throw in a little Dixie Hummingbirds or Golden Gate Quartet every now and then." Lula smiled and caught his eye. "He's a good boy, James. Thank the Lord for that." There was no argument. Lula was right. Willie James had a hard-to-explain quality that in the eyes of friends and relatives would somehow propel him past the grim life of smothered dreams and limited opportunity. Even James had seemed to come around in the last few months and believe in the possibilities. Lula's formal education had taken her only through the sixth grade. James had even less. 20+ years in Florida logging, an industry built on forced labor and peonage, had left James jaded. But suddenly the Howards were the proud parents of the only black teenager in Live Oak to land the job at the white-owned dime store. With her husband off to war, Mrs. Dot needed extra help. Not that a boy his color would have dared to step up to the counter, plop down his dime, and reach into the canisters for a fistful of double bubble, root beer barrels, and other penny candy. As a dutiful employee, however, Willie James had earned the manager's trust, working before and after school that autumn. Mrs. Dot made him full-time over Christmas break. Main Street shops were closed on Sundays, so Willie James had the day off. His father had no such reprieve. "What time will you be coming home tonight, James?" asked Lula. "Huh?" James was a good listener, as far as husbands went, but his hearing had slipped, a hazard of working at a sawmill. "Will you be home for supper?" Lula asked in a slightly louder voice. "Dunno," he said. The mill was short-handed with men off to war. Second shift on Sunday was supposed to be a half-day, but a 3-month timber harvest at the Mad Air Springs tract had been keeping crews busy well into the evening, 7 days a week. "I'll pack you something," said Lula. The drive continued to the outskirts of town, beyond the old railroad junction that dated back to the Civil War, where settlers and rail workers would rest in the shade of a massive oak, which, the story goes, is how live oak got its name. A live oak is never leafless, canopied year-round. Lula knew of no prettier sight than a centuries-old pillar of strength rising from a Florida pasture, its mighty limbs stretching out above the slash pines, palmettos, and white sand roads. James was alone in his thoughts, and Willie James was enjoying the breeze on his face with the window down. Lula checked her pompadour hat in the side-view mirror, and then her gaze drifted across the old crack in the windshield. It started on the passenger's side at the upper right corner, angled downward, then made a wide left turn in the shape of a C before dropping off sharply and disappearing into the dashboard. "Kinda like the Suwannee," Willie James had once remarked. And Lula had listened in awe as her then-11-year-old son proceeded to explain the circuitous path of the legendary river, which originates in the Okefenokee Swamp of south-central Georgia and hooks past Live Oak on its ceaseless journey to the Gulf of Mexico. Lula had never thought that big. The river, her dreams, and everything she'd ever known began and ended in Live Oak, where she was born and raised.
"Sorry about that," said James as the car bounced across a pothole.
They'd reached the end of the highway. Pavement gave way to gravel, until finally the road became a one-lane path of white sand covered with fallen pine needles, which at least kept some of the dust down. The Howard residence was like all the others in the area, a two-bedroom frame house that predated the Great Depression. The clapboard siding needed a good whitewashing, for which Lula had been saving pennies in a jar since moving in. James pulled up outside the gate, where the ground scrub had been flattened into a defined parking space. The engine continued to sputter even after he pulled the key from the ignition, as if the 10-year-old Buick had a mind of its own. They climbed out when the car settled, but the tailpipe emitted one last gasp as they started toward the house. North Central Florida had been dry and unseasonably warm since Christmas, and Willie James removed his suit jacket and tie before reaching the front door. James led the way inside and walked straight to the bedroom to change into his work coveralls. Lula went to the kitchen to pack her husband's lunch and, just in case, his supper.
"Bye, Mama," said Willie James.
He'd snuck up behind Lula at the counter, and as soon as she turned, he planted a quick kiss on her cheek.
"Where are you headed?"
"Just out back. Gonna teach Muggsy a few tricks."
Muggsy was a stray mutt that had followed Willie James home from the dime store. Lula cut an extra slice of meatloaf on the sandwich board.
"Take this. He'll learn faster."
"Thanks, Mama," he said,
and Willie James went quickly out the back door. Lula woke on the couch. The radio hissed from across the living room. She'd been listening to gospel music but dozed off, and the dial had drifted between stations. Lula switched off the radio and checked the clock on the end table. 12:05. The sun was streaking through the open window, floating dust mites aglow as if to confirm that it was 12:05 p.m., not a.m., and that Lula hadn't slept away the entire day. It would be hours before James returned from the sawmill. She sensed that she was still alone in the house, but she called her son's name nonetheless.
"Willie James?"
It was always Willie James, never just Willie, not even to his friends, and he always answered his mother if he was within earshot. She waited, but there was no reply. A car door slammed outside the house, startling Lula. She walked to the window, pulled the curtain to one side, and watched. Three white men were standing beside a sedan, talking. One stepped away and started toward the house. The other two waited at the gate. The lead man came to the screen door and knocked hard, much harder than necessary. Lula collected herself and went to the door.
"Yes, sir,"
she asked through the screen.
"Where is James?"
Lula had never seen his face before.
but she didn't dare break Jim Crow etiquette and directly ask a white man who he was or what he was doing, even if he had just shown up on her front step unexpectedly.
James is not here.
My name is Philip Goff,
he said with a measure of self-importance.
I need to find James.
He's gone to work.
Where's he working?
At the Bond Howell Lumber Company.
Where is Willie James?
Lula hesitated, her concern growing.
I don't know.
I think you do know, said Goff, his tone accusatory, if not threatening.
I fell asleep after church. He was.
Lula stopped, having heard the back door open. A call came from the kitchen.
Mama?
She glanced at Goff, who seemed perversely pleased to see Willie James enter the living room. A horrible feeling came over Lula, strong enough to make her wish that just this once her son had wandered off without telling his mother where he was headed, someplace no one could find him.
I saw the car pull up,
said Willie James. He went to his mother and stood beside her.
Everything all right?
Goff yanked open the screen door, stepped inside, and grabbed Willie James by the collar.
You're coming with me, boy.
Lula shrieked.
Why? What for?
Goff jerked Willie James forward, forcing himself between Lula and her son. Lula could barely speak.
What's this about? What has he done?
A pistol suddenly appeared, and Lula was staring straight down the business end of the polished barrel.
He's coming with me, Goff said.
Lula stepped back, her heart pounding with fear. Goff pulled Willie outside, forced him down the front step, and marched him down the walkway toward the gate. Lula hurried after them, pleading.
Why are you doing this? What has Willie James done?
Goff ignored her and pushed through the front gate to the waiting car. The other men jumped into action. One opened the rear door and the other helped shove Willie James into the back seat.
Mama!
Quiet!
Goff shouted, turning the pistol on Willie James. Lula lunged for the door, but Goff knocked her to the ground.
Please don't do this, she said, climbing to her knees. Sir, I'm begging you. Sir!
Goff slid into the back seat beside Willie James and pulled the door shut. His accomplices jumped into the front seat. The engine roared, the rear tires spun, and Lula shielded her face from a spray of dirt, sand, and pine needles. She pushed herself up and gave chase through a cloud of dust, her arms pumping and lungs burning.
Willie James! She cried,
the tears streaming down her face. Lula ran as fast and as far as she could, but the car got away from her. It continued beyond a hummock of oaks and disappeared from sight, the trail of dust evaporating into the clear blue sky. At the end of the sandy road, she fell to her knees, sobbing as she gasped for breath, wishing that her husband hadn't gone to the sawmill that Sunday, hating the town she was born in, and calling on her Lord and Savior to watch over Willie James. October, 74 years later. Chapter 1. The Suwannee River winds through the forested wetlands of north-central Florida like a tea-colored ribbon, its chilly waters connecting one small town to the next. Beneath it flows the watery underworld of the Florida aquifer, a limestone labyrinth of interconnecting caves and caverns that discharge billions of gallons of spring water every day. Feeder springs near Live Oak rise up through the riverbed and flow directly into the Suwannee, crystal clear water stained black by the tannins of vegetative decay. Countless other springs serve smaller rivers across the region, which eventually flow into the Great Suwannee or its tributaries. The recreational king among the feeder springs is Itchituckney. Tubing down the Itchituckney, a long, lazy float in an inflatable inner tube, had been a veritable rite of passage for generations of students from the University of Florida in Gainesville to the south and Florida State University in Tallahassee to the west.
Shit! This water is cold,
shouted Percy Donovan. He was waist-deep in the river. His girlfriend was afloat on an inner tube, and Percy was being a gentleman, guiding her away from the launch site so the current didn't carry her straight into the brush along the riverbank.
"That's not cold," said Shauna. "The guy at the tube rental said it's 72 degrees all year."
They'd met at UF, but Shauna was from Chicago. Percy was born and raised in Fort Lauderdale.
72 degrees puts enough ice in my veins to dunk on LeBron," said Percy.
Shauna laughed and splashed him, which sent Percy scurrying back to shore like a skipping stone in reverse. His friend Kelso watched from the bank, nearly falling over in laughter.
"Such a pussy!"
It struck Percy as funny that the fraternity brother calling him pussy was the only one in the group wearing a wetsuit. Kelso, too, was a South Floridian. There was nothing unusual about fraternities and sororities teaming up for a day trip down the river on a Saturday morning. Even in early October, when most of the country was raking leaves, but Florida was still sweating. It was the first time, however, that the black Greek letter organizations at UF and FSU, the Divine Nine as they were known, had coordinated such a trip. By 11 o'clock, more than 60 men and women were adrift in the lazy current. Some had rafted up into groups of six or eight to share conversation and laughter on the six-mile journey. A few couples broke off for an innocent kiss and a slightly less innocent breach of the no-skinny-dipping rule. Every now and then a shriek could be heard, followed by group laughter, as Kelso emerged from the black depths in his wetsuit, upended an inner tube and sent another bikini-clad student into the river for an involuntary swim.
"Kelso!"
shouted Shauna as she splashed to the surface. She was his third victim.
"Ha!" said Percy. "Who's cold now?"
Shauna climbed back into her inner tube.
"Cold? You ain't seen cold till you seen tonight, Percy."
That drew a chorus of oohs from friends. The group followed the bend past the halfway point, and Percy was beginning to wish that they'd signed up for the 90-minute float, not 3 hours. His butt was cold, the sun-baked rubber singed his skin every time he moved his leg, and holding on to an extra inner tube while Kelso swam off to play Loch Ness Monster was getting tiresome. Of course there were the marine science and horticulture majors who could have stayed all day and then some, pointing out every natural wonder along the river. Tall cypress trees rose from the marsh, their limbs reaching out over the river, providing ample shade for those who wanted out of the sun. Near the mouth of springs, the unstained waters were so clear that rafters appeared to float on air above the sandy riverbed. Every now and then a young woman shrieked at the sight of a motionless alligator or a turtle sunning itself on the banks. It was beautiful, unlike anything Percy had seen growing up in South Florida, which wasn't the South at all. A shrill scream suddenly jolted Percy from his oneness with nature. What the hell? It was very different from the playful screams Percy had heard earlier. This wasn't just another reptile sighting or sneak attack by Kelso. A couple of sorority sisters, the lead rafters who'd rounded the bend first, were in the water. Their inner tubes were floating farther downriver without them. Their arms flailed and legs kicked against the current as they frantically struggled to swim back to the group.
"Kelso, let's go!"
said Percy, as he shoved the extra tube toward his friend. Then he jumped into the river, and side by side, they swam with urgency, pushing their inner tubes ahead of them. Percy had never swum that fast in his life. With the current, it felt like the wind-aided record in the 100-yard dash he'd set at Dillard High School. Percy arrived first, and Kelso was just a few seconds behind him.
"Grab on!"
shouted Percy, and each woman draped an arm over the inner tube. Percy knew one of them from UF, Tamika. He held her, and Kelso grabbed the other, making sure they didn't slip away. They'd reached a sandbar in the middle of the river, so Percy planted his feet firmly and stopped the flotilla, allowing them time to catch their breath as the water rushed past them. Tamika gasped, but she looked more frightened than exhausted.
"What happened?"
asked Percy. Three other rafters floated alongside them,
and stopped at the sandbar. Tomika glanced at them and then back at Percy. The fear in her eyes remained as she turned her head toward the riverbank and pointed.
"An alligator?"
asked Kelso. She shook her head and pointed again, her hand shaking.
"In the forest?"
The tide was low, so the overflow along the banks had receded. The tall, trim trunks of cypress trees rose from the glassy black water. Hundreds of them, nature's version of a picket fence in front of a picket fence, making it hard to see daylight between the pencil-straight trees. Percy squinted and followed her finger to the point she was indicating. Beneath the cypress limbs, a shadowy figure hovered just above the swamp line.
"I think it's human," said Tomika.
Percy and Kelso exchanged a worried glance.
"Wait here,"
said Percy, and he started swimming toward the bank. Kelso followed. The current fought them until they reached an eddy at the bend. The river was a different place at its flooded banks, where flowing spring water gave way to the stillness of swampland. Splashes of sunlight broke through the occasional opening in the leaf canopy, brightening the Spanish moss that hung from limbs like tattered old fishing nets. With the gentle sounds of moving water behind him, Percy could discern the oral signs of wildlife in the wetlands. The croak of bullfrogs, the screech of a hungry bird in flight, perhaps a heron or an osprey. Percy breathed heavier with each stroke toward the bank. The river became shallower, and even though the black-stained water remained transparent, a rich muck had replaced the sandy bed. Percy's knee grazed the bottom, which was more than enough to stir up years of decomposition and the sulfuric odor of the marsh.
"Dude, there could be gators here,"
said Kelso. Percy was undeterred but not unaware. He pulled himself up onto a fallen cypress tree, careful not to slip, as the smooth trunk had lost its bark to the river's rising and falling tides. He gazed into the forest and did a double take. Something was suspended from a tree limb. And Tomika was right. It did appear human. Percy took a few more steps along the fallen tree and stopped, barely able to trust his eyes. It was a man. A black man. Hanging at the end of a taut rope, with a noose around his neck. An anger and sickness rose inside Percy, even more intense than his feelings upon seeing for the first time those chilling old photographs from the days of Jim Crow. It wasn't exactly like those black-and-white images, however, in which the bare feet of a black man hung in perfect vertical alignment with the victim's eerily elongated frame. This body was contorted, the man's ankles and wrists bound together behind his back. He'd been hogtied.
"What the fuck?"
said Kelso. He was a few steps behind Percy, having climbed onto the same fallen tree. Percy's heart pounded. Part of him wanted to turn back, but he put one foot in front of the other, stepping deeper into the swamp. All the way to the upturned roots of the fallen cypress tree, where he froze. Percy recognized the man.
"It's Jamal's cousin."
"Who?" asked Kelso. He was right behind Percy.
"Alpha President," said Percy.
Percy and Kelso were Kappas, and the only fraternity higher in the Divine Nine pecking order was the Alpha House. Jamal had been a conspicuous no-show for the tubing trip, but no one had suspected this.
"Holy shit."
"Yeah," Percy said in disbelief. A hog-tied body was definitely no suicide.
"Jamal's been lynched."
Chapter 2.
On that steamy Saturday afternoon at Florida Field, the swamp, 90,000 screaming fans cheered the Florida Gators to a 17-14 victory over the Rebels of Ole Miss. Fraternity Row had reason to party. Even if that team from Tuscaloosa was still number one in the nation,
Chug, 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 chug.
It was a chant heard all over Gainesville, as natty light flowed through beer bongs like chilly water through Suwannee Springs. Around midnight, the post-game celebration was popping at Theta Pi Omega, the premier fraternity on the UF campus. Theta had over 100 active brothers, 60 of whom lived in the two-story antebellum-style house. Most were legacies, their fathers and grandfathers having pledged before them. Not one was black. Party Central at the Theta House was the main oversized room on the ground floor, which was packed with students gripping red solo cups, a few holding one in each hand. Spotify supplied the latest hits at deafening levels. Some students danced, mostly groups of drunk girls entertaining drunker frat boys. The honor of administering the beer bong went to whoever had just turned 21, so long as she looked good in a string bikini and stiletto heels. There was serious action at the beer pong table, not to be confused with the beer bong, which in turn was nothing compared to the bong within a bong, an ingenious device that was kept upstairs for anyone who liked to drink beer and smoke pot in one seamless, mind-blowing hit. Mark Towson stepped away from his friends, walked around the rowdy crowd at the beer pong table, and introduced himself to the blonde who had caught his eye from across the room. "I'm Mark," he said, loud enough to be heard over the music. "Lisa," she shouted back. He signaled toward the hallway and she followed him to a smaller room where they could hear each other talk, so long as they didn't mind the couple making out on the couch. "Can I get you something to drink?"
Sure, she said.
Mark shook his head.
"Bad girl."
"Huh?"
"Never, never let someone get a drink for you. Get your own drink. Preferably in a can that you opened yourself."
Okay.
"Freshman, right?"
She seemed a bit deflated.
"How'd you know?"
"Lucky guess.
And I saw you ditch the bunny ears in the bushes before coming through the front door.
Always double-check when an upperclassman invites you to a costume party."
She smiled.
"You're just a fountain of good advice, aren't you?"
"You don't get to be Theta president if you haven't seen it all."
"Ah,"
she said, as if her eyes had suddenly been opened. "Should I start humming Hail to the Chief, Mr. President?"
"I prefer Fanfare for the Common Man."
She laughed, but she clearly didn't get it.
"Anyway," said Mark, "who'd you come to the party with?"
"My roommate."
"Where is she now?"
"No clue."
"You know, if we were playing baseball, that would be strike three."
She laughed.
"Are you hitting on me, or did my father hire you to be my chaperone?"
Mark smiled back, then turned a little more serious.
"My sister's a sophomore. Did some dumb things her freshman year. Call it my big brother instinct."
A Theta brother interrupted them. It was Bane Robinson, house treasurer, and his expression was stone-cold serious.
"Cops or outside?"
Mark didn't flinch. It was nothing he hadn't handled before, and it was the reason he no longer drank alcohol at frat parties.
"Got it. Hey, it was nice meeting you, Lisa."
"Right,"
she said as Mark started away.
"So, like, do you want my number?"
Mark glanced over his shoulder, still walking.
"I'll bet Bane does."
She shrugged and Bane stayed behind with her. Mark continued down the hallway to the foyer. Word of the badges outside was starting to spread, and underage drinkers scrambled upstairs to hide. Suddenly the house was filled with students holding only cell phones, as no one was stupid enough to be seen through a window chugging from the telltale red solo cup. The front door had been wide open all night, but Mark pulled it shut on his way out into the warm night air. He crossed the lawn to the curb, where two squad cars were parked. The police beacons were still flashing, lighting up the front yard with the orange swirl of authority. Four uniformed officers from the Alachua County Sheriff's Department were standing outside the cars, waiting beneath an oak tree.
"Good evening, officers," he said in his most respectful tone. "I'm Mark Towson, Theta President."
"Towson, huh?" said one of the officers.
His name tag identified him as Sergeant Walsh.
"You're one of the boys we want to talk to." That took Mark aback. He'd always been the designated Theta spokesperson when parties got too loud, but never had the police shown up looking for him by name.
"If it's about the party, we're more than happy to..."
"It's not just about the party," the sergeant said.
"Okay. How can I help you then?"
"I'm sure you heard about Jamal Cousin." The apparent lynching of the president of the Alpha House had been on the news and social media all day.
"Yeah, terrible,"
said Mark.
"Unbelievable something like that could happen."
"Did you know Jamal?"
"I met him.
All the fraternity presidents meet as a group a couple times a year. But I wouldn't say I know him. Knew him," he said, correcting himself.
"That's part of the problem.
For you boys, it's party as usual, but that ain't the case over at the Black Houses." "Are you asking me to shut it down?"
"Excellent idea," said Walsh.
"No problem.
I'll take care of it."
"Put someone else in charge of that. We want you to come down to the station with us."
Mark glanced nervously at the other officers and back at Walsh.
"What's this about?"
"Relax," the sergeant said. "We're not here to arrest anyone. The chief deputy wants to sit down face to face with campus leaders like yourself. He's being proactive so we don't have a full-blown riot on campus tomorrow."
"The chief wants to meet with me?"
"Now?"
"Yeah, you, Bane Robinson, and Cooper Bartlett."
"Why Bane and Cooper?"
"Because those are the names the chief deputy gave me. You got a problem with it?"
Mark hesitated. Bane and Cooper were definitely not sober.
"I don't know."
The sergeant's expression tightened.
"Look, son, you college kids live in a bubble. But we're sitting on a powder keg from here to Live Oak. The president of a black fraternity was lynched. Jamal Cousin was an honor student and supposed to start medical school next fall."
"I didn't know that."
"Well, the whole world knows it now. Folks are pissed, and they got a right to be. But there's also some badass gangs pouring into town from Miami, Tampa, Atlanta, and God only knows where else. If you give a rat's ass about this university, get your frat brothers to shut down this party right now, grab your two friends, and come with us. It's too late once the buildings are on fire and there's rioting in the streets, which could happen any minute now."
Mark glanced back at the house, still wishing there was a way he could do this alone.
"All right," he said finally. "I'll be right back."
Chapter 3. Mark Towson and his two fraternity brothers rode shoulder to shoulder in the back seat of a squad car to the Alachua County Sheriff's Department. Mark wasn't worried about Bane. A 20-minute ride and the seriousness of the situation were enough to sober him up. Cooper looked like he was going to vomit as they entered the station. And he did.
"Oh, man, I feel so much better now,"
said Cooper, and then he threw up on the tile floor again.
"Dude, you're gonna get us arrested," said Bane.
"Nobody's getting arrested," said Sergeant Walsh. He gave Cooper a towel and sent him off to the bathroom to clean himself up. "You two, come with me," he said, and Mark and Bane followed him down the hall. Mark assumed that they were all headed to the same place, but he was wrong. Walsh stopped at the first door, opened it, and directed Bane inside with another deputy. He then led Mark to a door at the other end of the hall and showed him to the windowless room. Two men were seated at a small rectangular table. They rose and invited Mark to have a seat opposite them, which he did. Sergeant Walsh left the room, closing the door behind him. The older man spoke first.
Thank you for coming in, Mr. Townsend. With your permission, I'd like to record this conversation.
The man's finger was already on the record button.
No problem, said Mark.
With a click, the recording started, and the man's voice took on an official tone.
My name is Oliver Bolt, State Attorney and Chief Legal Officer for the 3rd Judicial District of Florida. With me is Detective Josh Proctor of the Suwanee County Sheriff's Department.
Suwanee County? Asked Mark.
That's correct, Bolt answered. He looked like a state attorney, or at least as Mark would have imagined one. His hair was mostly gray and cut short, and even at this hour he wore a suit and tie, as if to announce that he was in control.
Bolt continued in a businesslike tone.
With us on a voluntary basis is Mr. Mark Towson, a 21-year-old student at the University of Florida. It is 12:52 a.m., Sunday, October the 7th. I will now turn things over to Detective Proctor.
Proctor cleared his throat, then began.
Mr. Towson, have you had any alcoholic beverages this evening?
No.
Are you under the influence of any recreational drugs?
No.
Any prescription or over-the-counter medications?
No.
Would you consider yourself mentally impaired in any way at this time?
No, but hold on, okay? I was told that we were going to talk about how to keep the campus safe.
These questions make it sound like I don't know what.
Do you have something to hide, Mr. Towson? The detective asked.
Well, no, but...
But you don't want to answer any questions. Even routine questions, is that it?
I didn't say that. I've just never been in a situation like this.
Let me be clear about what the situation is, said the detective. You are not under arrest for anything. We are here having a conversation. Can we have a conversation, Mr. Towson?
The question didn't leave any room to push back.
Yeah? Sure?
Detective Proctor paused for some reason. Mark wasn't sure why. The silence was insufferable. Finally, the detective put the next question.
Do you own a cell phone, Mr. Towson?
Yeah, sure.
Can you confirm the number for me?
Mark was getting so nervous that he actually had to think for a moment before reciting it. The detective laid a printed transcript on the table before Mark.
Mr. Towson, this is a verbatim record of a text message that was found on the cell phone of Jamal Cousin. Could you read it, please?
Mark read it to himself, then cringed.
Out loud, please, said the detective.
His voice quaked as he read it.
Watch your ass on the float, nigger. Strange fruit on the river. Thank you, said the detective. Can you flip to the next page, please?
Mark did.
This is a call report from Mr. Cousin's cell carrier, said the detective. It shows the number for every incoming call or text, whether or not that number is on Mr. Cousin's actual cell. Look at the third line from the bottom, Mr. Towson. Do you recognize that number?
The paper shook in Mark's hand.
I didn't write this text.
That's your cell number, right?
It's my number, but I didn't send that text. I don't even know Jamal's cell number.
It's in the Interfraternity Council directory, is it not, Mr. Towson? The cell numbers of all chapter presidents are listed there, correct?
That was true, and Mark wasn't sure how to respond.
Okay, forget that. Just look at the message. I never used the N-word.
And strange fruit, I don't even know what that means. I didn't send this text.
Then how did it get from your cell to Jamal's?
I don't know. When was it sent?
The Saturday before Jamal's death. 11:51 p.m. Mark didn't have to think long to pinpoint his whereabouts.
I was at a theta party just like the one we were having tonight. Anybody could have picked up my cell and sent it.
Let's be real, Mr. Towson. You kids don't ever put down your cell phones.
Mark didn't argue. Instead, he scrolled through his text history, and then, with a sigh of relief, handed his cell to the detective.
Nothing to Jamal Cousin, see? I didn't send it.
The detective took Mark's phone, but he didn't even look at the screen.
I wouldn't expect you to keep this message after sending it. Unfortunately for you, Jamal did.
Mark reached for his cell, expecting it to be returned, but the detective placed it on the law enforcement side of the table, keeping it close at hand. Then he continued.
Phone records show that Jamal Cousin also received a text message from Cooper Bartlett and another one from Bain Robinson. Lucky for them, Jamal deleted the message, so we don't know what was said. But those messages were sent just a few minutes after the one you sent.
I didn't send any message!
The state attorney interjected, his tone much friendlier than the detective's.
Mark, we'd really like to know what your friends texted to Jamal.
I don't know anything about any text messages to Jamal.
The detective leaned closer, retaking control.
Let's cut to the chase here, Mr. Towson. The critical time period here is roughly 18 to 26 hours ago. Can you tell us where you were late Friday night and after midnight till about 2 a.m. Saturday?
Mark glanced at the state attorney, who offered a nod of encouragement.
We're just looking for the truth, Mark.
I went to bed pretty early, like 11:30. I had an accounting midterm Friday morning and was up late Thursday studying.
What time did you get up on Saturday?
Probably around 10.
Was anyone with you?
No. That's one of the perks of being president. I get my own room.
No girlfriend?
Mark shook his head. The detective put an even finer point on it.
So no one but you can tell us where you were from 11:30 Friday night until 10 a.m. Saturday. Is that right?
Mark froze. The state attorney tried his good cop routine again.
You can answer, Mark.
We just need your help. You don't want my help. This is crazy. You're trying to pin this on us.
The men stared back in silence. Mark took a breath.
Seriously? You think the three of us lynched Jamal Cousin? Is that what this is about?
We're just three adults having a conversation.
The state attorney said in a matter-of-fact tone.
No one's accusing you of anything. You're not under arrest.
Yeah, you keep saying that, but...
Mark stopped himself.
Can I have my cell back, please?
It was inches from the detective's elbow. He slid it across the table and Mark caught it.
Another text message you need to delete?
The detective asked.
Yeah, how'd you know?
Said Mark, instantly regretting the sarcasm. Then he pressed entry number 1 on his contact list, which simply read, Dad. Chapter 4 Jack Switek woke to a warm face washing and dog breath.
Max, he said, groaning as he nudged his golden retriever away from the bed. The bedroom was dark, not a sliver of sunlight coming through the windows.
Jack had just finished a 2-week jury trial on Friday afternoon. Saturday had been the first date with his wife in a fortnight, and Sunday was his day to sleep in.
Get up, Daddy!
It was something Max would have said if he could talk, but the voice was that of his 3-year-old daughter. Jack rolled over and checked the clock on the nightstand. 5:11 a.m.
Riley, honey, do you have any idea what time it is?
Time to get up.
Mommy, he said hopefully.
He reached across to Andy's side of the mattress, but she wasn't there. For 2 months, she'd been training for a half marathon. On weekdays, she took to the treadmills at the Miami field office, which were available to all FBI agents. On weekends, she did her road work, but rarely before sunrise. Too many drunks still driving home. Yet there she was, standing at the foot of the bed, dressed in running clothes and ready to head out.
Why so early?
Your father woke me up. Harry Switek was the former governor of Florida, since retired from politics.
My father?
He called your cell at 5. You slept through it. I didn't.
What does he want?
He said he'll meet you at the executive airport at 6:15. It's important. You're going to Gainesville. The twin-engine prop plane left Miami at 6:35 a.m. with 5 rows of empty seats separating Jack and his father from the only other passenger on the flight. Jack had seen Saturday's media coverage of Florida's first lynching in more than 50 years. It was the lead story on the evening news statewide, and national networks had also covered it. By the time Jack had gone to bed, bloggers were abuzz and social media was overheating, though the name Towson had not yet been mentioned. Harry thanked Jack for a third time after takeoff.
Tucker Towson was a college kid knocking on doors for me when I ran for state legislator. By my second term as governor, he was my deputy chief of staff. I think of him like a little brother.
I get it, said Jack.
I should have checked with you before telling him you'd fly up with me, said Harry. But when an old friend calls at 4 o'clock in the morning and says his son is in serious trouble, you just get on a plane and, Dad, it's no problem, really.
15 years of criminal defense work and a string of high-profile trials, mostly capital cases, including one in which his client was finally proven innocent after 4 years on death row, had earned Jack an impressive reputation. Still, Jack was under no illusion that this gig was strictly about his legal prowess. Although his father had been out of office for more than a decade, the surname Switek still carried weight, especially at the University of Florida, Harry's alma mater. Jack spent the first half of the flight listening as Harry brought him up to speed on his call from Tucker, including what Tucker had told him about the racist text message from Mark Towson's phone. Then Jack took to the Internet. 10 minutes before landing, Jack looked up from his iPad and said,
"There's absolutely no mention anywhere of that text message from Mark to Jamal." "You sure?"
Jack was. Saturday's coverage had focused on the tragic loss of life, with endless words of praise from relatives, friends, teachers, and virtually anyone who'd ever known Jamal Cousin. The Sun Sentinel story about an inner-city kid who stayed out of gangs and became the first in his family to attend college was downright inspirational. The breaking news on Sunday morning was that 3 white fraternity brothers had been hauled in for questioning and released sometime after midnight, and that one of them was the son of Tucker Towson, former deputy chief of staff to Governor Switek. Law enforcement refused to comment further.
"The police must be keeping that part of the investigation confidential," said Jack. "Maybe they don't want to release until they can prove for sure that Mark sent it, which is reasonable. If that text is as bad as Tucker told me, his son will need a bodyguard when it goes public."
The jet landed at Gainesville Regional Airport around 8 o'clock. A taxi took them toward campus. Jack was still on his iPad, reviewing the latest coverage, when he looked up and noticed how the business side of University Avenue had changed since his undergraduate days, except for the colors.
"I see Sherwin-Williams is still running a sale on orange and blue," said Jack.
The driver took them past the main campus, then past the law school, and finally to a quiet residential neighborhood west of the university. Tucker and his wife Elizabeth had met as freshmen at UF and moved back to Gainesville in their 50s, not out of nostalgia, but because UF Health Shands Cancer Hospital offered Elizabeth a fighting chance against breast cancer. Both their children attended UF, and the empty nesters lived alone in a four-bedroom ranch-style house at the end of a cul-de-sac. It wasn't often that Mark spent a Saturday night at home, but last night had been an exception.
"I wasn't expecting this," said Harry as the taxi turned into the Townsend Street.
A group of students had already gathered at the end of the street. They were not from the Gator Welcome Committee. Jack counted about a dozen demonstrators, blacks and whites, their posters sending a message to the neighborhood. Justice for Jamal. End hatred.
"I figured there would be protests at the Theta House," said Harry. "But not here."
"The article in the Sun mentioned that Mark graduated from Gainesville High," said Jack. "They must have guessed he'd go home to deal with this."
A demonstrator stepped toward the taxi and brandished her sign, "Racism is taught."
"Or they blame his parents," said Harry.
The taxi continued past the demonstrators, pulled into the driveway, and stopped. Jack reached for the door handle, but Harry stopped him.
"Before we go in, there's something I want to be totally clear about."
"Sure?"
"Tucker is a special friend, so I was happy to arrange this meeting. But I made no commitments beyond that."
"We'll see how it goes. I'm not finished," said Harry.
"I'm
all
for keeping an innocent college kid from becoming the victim of a witch hunt, which is what Tucker assures me this is. But if the boy actually sent that text message and gets indicted for lynching Jamal Cousin, I have no problem with you walking away from this case."
"Dad, he wouldn't be my first guilty client. And even if he did send that text, it doesn't mean he killed Jamal."
Harry grimaced. "See, you're already doing it."
"Doing what?"
"Your Freedom Institute mindset."
Jack's first job out of law school at the Freedom Institute, defending death row inmates after Governor Harry Switek signed their death warrant, had once divided this father and son. They'd worked past it over the years, or so Jack had thought.
"Do you want me to help this kid or not?" asked Jack.
Harry breathed out. "If he's being railroaded, I do. But if he's not..."
"If he's not, then he really needs my help."
"Damn it, Jack, now I'm sorry I called you."
"Why?"
"Because you're not a hotshot young lawyer fresh out of law school who can do whatever he pleases. You're married to a law enforcement officer."
"Andy would never tell me what cases to take."
"Of course she wouldn't, but have some sense, Jack."
"I'm speaking now as a former cop. Andy is out there in the field every day. Black agents, white agents, they all got each other's back.
And you think that's going to change because I defend Mark Towson?" "If he sent that text, it will. Look, Jack, if you come out of this meeting saying I'm in this no matter what, that's up to you. But if Tucker's son did this, and Andy asks my opinion, I'm not going to pretend that you're doing me any favors for my old friend. I'll be the first to give you a swift kick in the ass for defending the racist son of a bitch. Understood?"
"Yeah," said Jack, his gaze drifting toward the line of demonstrators at the end of the driveway.
"Understood."
Chapter 5. Jack met alone with his new client in the dining room. Harry waited in the living room with Tucker and Elizabeth Towson. The pocket door was closed for privacy, The furniture was traditional, straight out of an Ethan Allen showroom. The framed portrait hanging on the cabbage rose wallpaper captured Mark with his parents and younger sister in a much happier time.
"I had nothing to do with this," said Mark.
"That's a good start," said Jack.
They spoke for almost an hour, covering everything from the first time Mark met Jamal to the police interrogation. One new piece of information was that all three boys had left the sheriff's office without their cell phones. By the time the interrogation ended, the police had obtained a warrant to seize the phones.
"The detective kept telling me I wasn't under arrest," said Mark.
"They don't have to arrest you to seize your cell phone."
"But why did he keep saying that?" "I felt like he was telling me that if I tried to leave, he would arrest me."
"Bluffs like that are standard police interrogation tactics," said Jack. "The detective was also making it clear on the recording that he wasn't legally required to tell you that you have the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. Miranda doesn't kick in until you're arrested."
"Seemed slimy to me. Especially after they lied to get me to come to the station. The cop said it was to talk about campus safety."
"That's allowed. As long as the police have a good reason to lie."
"What reason could they have other than to trick me?"
"We can ask, but it doesn't take a genius to think one up."
"That sucks. This whole thing sucks."
Frustration was setting in. It was obvious that Mark hadn't slept all night, like all clients who lie awake and overanalyze the predicament. There was a knock at the door, and Mark's father entered.
"Jack, sorry to interrupt, but it's important.
There's something you should see on the TV." He pronounced TV like Stevie. His son had inherited the Townsend height and preppy good looks, but the accent was all Tucker.
"All right, let's break."
Jack and his client rose and followed Tucker into the living room. Harry had stepped out. Elizabeth was seated on the couch. The worry lines Jack had noticed on her face just an hour earlier now seemed carved in wax. A 60-inch flat screen hung on the wall. Frozen on the screen and queued up to replay was the image of an African-American legal giant in Florida. The banner below his face read, "Leroy Highsmith, attorney and spokesperson for the Cousin family." He was standing before a bouquet of microphones from at least a dozen different news organizations.
"Do you know Highsmith?" asked Tucker.
"I've met him," said Jack. "He's not a criminal defense lawyer. More like a criminal. He's a plaintiff's lawyer."
"Same thing."
The man built his practice on have-you-been-injured billboards posted on all roads out of Disney World. His specialty is convincing juries that every bump on the noggin is a life-threatening brain injury.
"He has definitely won some big verdicts," said Jack.
"And he's at it again."
"At what again?" asked Jack.
"One of the boys the police took down to the station last night is Bane Robinson. That family is loaded. Bane's father is a citrus baron from Orange County, probably one of the richest men ever to graduate from UF. The Robinson School of Agriculture was named after Bane's grandfather."
"I'm not sure I follow your point about Leroy Highsmith," said Jack.
"Highsmith practically has his own cottage industry suing companies like Robinson Citrus." "Watch," said Tucker, reaching for the television remote. "Listen to what Highsmith just said 5 minutes ago in this press conference, and you'll see what I mean." Tucker pressed the remote, rewound the DVR, and the on-screen image came to life. Highsmith was a gifted orator, speaking with the passion of a preacher and the precision of a brilliant lawyer. "Strange fruit," he said, holding a transcript of the text message in his left hand. "Strange fruit hanging from the tree. Chilling words that Billie Holiday sang so powerfully more than 75 years ago.
But this isn't 1939, you say? The days when just looking at a white man the wrong way could cost a black man his life are over, you say? Lynchings are behind us, you say?
He paused for effect, then lowered his voice.